The little louse didn't die, thank God. But it was a near-run thing. Apart from a broken nose, his skull was fractured, and for a couple of days he hung on the edge, with a Bristol horse-leech working like fury to save him. I went through the tortures of the pit. They had confined me to my room, Locke was a justice of the peace, and kept me there, with the muff doobly sitting outside the door like a blasted water bailiff. I was in a fearful sweat, for if Bryant kicked the bucket, it would be a hanging matter. It was small consolation to learn from Dubley that there was by no means complete agreement that I had been cheating. Disraeli had sensibly pointed out that a detected cheat wouldn't have hauled the evidence out of his pocket publicly as soon as he was challenged. But most of the other pious hypocrites disagreed, and the general feeling was that I would be well served if I finished up in the prison lime pit. Whatever happened, it was a hideous scandal. The house had emptied next day, and I was a liability to Morrison henceforth. He came to see me on the fifth day and told me that Bryant was out of danger, and I was so relieved I was almost happy as I listened to him denounce me for a wastrel, a fornicator, a cheat, a liar, and a brute. When he was done, he plumped down, breathing like a bellows, and says,
"You're easier out of this than you deserve. A beast, that's what you are, Flashman, a raging, evil beast."
And he mopped his face.
"Well, Locke isn't going to press charges. You have me to thank for that, and this fellow Bryant'll keep mum. A few hundred'll take care of him. He's another officer and gentleman like yourself. I could buy the lot of you just trash."
He shot me a look.
"But we'll no hush up the scandal for that. You canny come home, you're aware of that, I suppose."
I didn't argue, but I was ill-advised enough to mutter something about Elspeth, and for a moment I thought he would strike me.
"Mention her name to me again, just once again, and God's my witness, I'll see you transported for this week's work. You'll rue the day you ever set eyes on her, aye, as I have done most bitterly. God alone knows what I and mine have done to be punished by you. You'll be best out of England for a spell until this damnable business is blown by. You'll go at once to Poovil. Take a room at the Admiral and wait until you hear from me. Not a word to a soul, and never stir out, or you'll find my protection and Locke's is withdrawn, and that'll be a felon cell for you, and beggary to follow."
I waited a week in Poole, gradually getting my spirits back. At least I was free, and whatever lay in front of me, I'd come back to England eventually, and the trouble would be forgotten. I would just have to make the best of whatever he had in store for me. What that was, I discovered on the eighth day, when a man called to see me as I was chivying after the servant lass who had come to clear away my breakfast dishes. She was bleating that she was a good girl. When the knock sounded, she took advantage of it to escape, admitting the visitor, while she snapped her indignation at me. "Sauce," says she,
"I never."
"Get out," says the newcomer, and she fled. He kicked the door to with his heel and stood looking at me. And there was something in that look that made me bite back from cursing him. At first glance, he was ordinary enough, square-built, middle height, plain trousers and tight-buttoned jacket, low-crowned round hat which he didn't trouble to remove, and stiff-trimmed beard and moustache which gave him a powerful, business-like air. But it was the man's eyes. They were as pale as water in a china dish, bright and yet empty, and as cold as an ice floe. They looked at you with a blind, fathomless stare that told you here was a terrible man. Above them, on his brow, there was a puckered scar which, when he was enraged, as he often was, turned red.